Hello, I'm really sorry that I can't join the 2014 edition of the Cambridge seminar today, but I'm glad I can share some thoughts with you by video. Just a bit of context on our measurement in PISA. You can see a map of the countries for which we currently have data, and they took the last assessment in the year 2012. That's the kind of data I'm going to talk about most of the time here. Over 500,000 students were assessed in the 65 countries taking part. They take this test that tries to go beyond whether students can just reproduce what they have learned towards testing their creative skills, the capacity to extrapolate from what they know, use and apply their knowledge in unfamiliar, novel situations. And we also collect a lot of data from parents, from students, from school leaders, increasingly also from teachers, to better understand the context in which students learn, teachers work, and schools operate. One of the things that we've asked ourselves recently is how far we can stretch the PISA model the more and more countries that are wanting to join this assessment. But for some, you know, it's actually very, very hard to basically use the kind of PISA methodology, for example, because a large share of 15-year-olds may no longer be enrolled in school, or the tasks that we pose in PISA may not be appropriate in their respective school and cultural context, and so on. One of the things that we are piloting currently over the years 2014 to 2017 is a new approach that would enable some of the countries that have expressed an interest to actually join the assessment. We've started this in Zambia and Tanzania and Cambodia and Senegal and Ecuador and Guatemala. Those are the countries that are piloting this new approach, an approach that is looking at new types of contextual data, for example, in how we measure social economic context, that is piloting new types of PISA tasks, and that is looking at whether we can assess students out of the school context. Our experience so far has really been that the relevance of the PISA approach is perceived by many countries beyond those currently taking part. They're also willing to adhere to the technical standards, so on. And about the open issues is really whether we can achieve a better match between student ability distribution and the task difficulties that we pose, that we increase the relevance of the context questionnaire, and that we actually get a handle on out-of-school population, the kind of things I talk about. Against that context, what is it? How do we define quality and equity? Basically, it's about giving every student the chance to succeed. And that means raising the bar. Equity at the price of mediocrity is not a desirable goal, but it's also about leveling the bar. And I'm going to talk about some of the policies and practices that we have identified lying behind this based on PISA. Basically, in most countries, you can see a pretty strong relationship between social background and learning outcomes. We call this the social gradient. The only exceptions really are the northern countries in Europe, some of them, and some of the countries in East Asia. So that's basically what it's about. Let's have a look at the reality today. What you can see here is the picture in Brazil. Again, on the vertical axis, you see the performance of schools, and on the horizontal axis, you see their social and economic background. What you can see is that there is a pretty strong relationship. Now, if you come live in a privileged background, your school performance is likely to be a lot better. If you live in a disadvantaged background on the left side of the chart, your school performance is likely to be a lot lower. There are a lot of exceptions from this pattern. Now, the schools do not fall on one line. In some contexts, you know, even disadvantaged schools seem to be doing really well. And other quite privileged schools don't show that great result. So, you know, social background and learning outcomes are not deterministically linked, but they are linked. What you can also see in the case of Brazil, I've marked the private schools in green and the public schools in white, is that the rich families have essentially bought themselves out of the system. Now, all of the dots on the right side really seem to be the ones that families send their children to private schools, and they do better. But once you account for the social context, in fact, they pretty much follow the same pattern. What's behind that? One hypothesis is it's all about individual family background. Now, wealthier parents being able to devote more resources to education, being able to sort of maybe also able to read more to their children, all these kind of things. But in fact, you can calculate that line, and it's actually a lot flatter than what we see. So it's not just about family background. If you actually look at the aggregate impact that school performance has on outcomes, you can see a much stronger relationship, and which tells us actually that education systems make a very important difference in the kind of patterns that we observe. Let's have a look at a couple of other countries here. Jordan. Jordan, all of the schools are wealthier on average. Now the whole cloud has shifted somehow to more socioeconomic advantage. But the schools are not doing better than those in Brazil. That's a really interesting pattern. So again, across countries, we also see that social background is not deterministically linked to outcomes. Have a look at another country, Vietnam. That's very impressive. You can see those schools operate largely in significant socioeconomic disadvantage. Now, Vietnam is still a very poor country. But you can see all of the dots, public, private, and rural, and urban schools, they're all a lot higher position than what you can see in Brazil and Jordan. This is telling us that actually, even in disadvantaged context, we can leverage, or some countries are able to leverage learning outcomes. This is all about, you know, equity and social context. And that actually tells us that basically we all often have made a false choice between quality and excellence in education. Let's have a look at this in a bit more detail. Now look at a larger selection of countries. Basically here, that's the familiar ranking of PISA countries. Now in green are the countries doing well on PISA, yellow the countries doing so-so, and in red the countries with sort of below average performance. Large performance gap among countries. Let's add the equity dimension to this. Now, basically, in some countries, social background makes a big difference on learning outcomes. In others, learning outcomes are a lot more equitably distributed. Everybody wants to be here where performance is good and all students succeed. Nobody wants to be there where performance is poor and there are large social disparities. But in fact, you know, much of the policy and practice in education actually focuses on, you know, trading off excellence against equity, or, you know, focusing on equity and sacrificing quality. But once again, you look at the PISA countries more systematically, and you can see there's a fair number of countries in the green quadrant showing that we can actually combine quality and excellence. And actually, very few countries succeed in raising quality while sacrificing equity. Very important. One last dimension added to this is money. The size of the dot that you see here represents the spending per student, and you can actually see, you know, neither quality and equity directly relate to the volume of spending. If money would tell you everything about the quality of the school system, you would see all the large bubbles at the top and all the small bubbles at the bottom, but that's not what these data show. It's more to do with how we allocate resources. How would you actually direct resources to where they are most needed? How do we attract the most talented teachers to the most challenging schools to get the best and strongest principals, the most experienced principals into the toughest schools? So things have a lot more to do with equity and quality than just volume of spending. Well, some people still say, oh, what you see here is about, you know, culture and history and those kinds of contextual factors that are very, very hard to change. But, you know, the most powerful argument against this is that we have actually seen a lot of changes in this pattern. If you look at the top end of the distribution, in 2009 you could see Shanghai still on the map. Now they have actually moved upwards beyond what you can see on the screen. Or Singapore, another country that continues to improve, relentlessly improving learning outcomes. But even at the bottom of the scale, now look at Turkey, where you find Turkey today, and look at where Turkey was in the year 2000. Three. And what you can actually see is that Turkey has been able to raise outcomes, the dot is moving upwards, but also closing the social economic gap. Very, very impressive outcomes. Or you can see Germany, raising outcomes a bit, but actually been very successful in reducing social disparities. Closing the gap between the students with an immigrant background and those coming from families without an immigrant background. Very, very important achievement. Or Italy. Raising outcomes, closing the gap. Poland, not so strong on the equity, but you could actually see it's the country with the largest improvement gains in Europe. Portugal, moving a bit backwards on equity. That's a warning signal, but at the very same time, actually being very successful in giving more students better learning outcomes. Very, very important outcomes. We've also measured this in a different way, and that is basically the capacity of education systems to leverage excellence among students from disadvantage. We call those students resilient. If you are in Shanghai, Hong Kong, Vietnam, Singapore, and so on, many Asian countries, but also Switzerland and Europe, you have a fairly large share of the most disadvantaged students still displaying excellent results. Yeah. In most other countries, the relationship is less positive. Now, there are some students who succeed, but actually the proportion is quite limited. And then you have a fair number of countries where you can say actually poverty is destiny, where that kind of resilience isn't very pronounced. Very important to look at this. The one thing I want to add though is, you know, as powerful as social background is hindering equalities, is that the country where students go to class still matters a lot more than the social class from which students come. Have a look at the following chart. This shows you the performance of students by decile of social background. If you are from the 10% of the poorest kids in Mexico, you do a lot worse than if you come from the 10% of the most privileged students. Well, we have seen that in other slides before already. But it's not the same across countries. If you're in Chile, you're actually a lot worse off if you come from the 10% most disadvantaged students. And you're better off if you come from the 10% most privileged students. Well, if you actually look at this across countries, you can see that actually that varies quite significantly across countries. You can't say that, you know, privileged students succeed everywhere. They succeed to quite different extent. And the disadvantaged students, variability in the performance of the 10% most disadvantaged students is even greater. One of the things that make a country like, you know, Japan or Shanghai or so special is that even the most disadvantaged students outperform the most privileged students in other countries. The 10% students from the poorest families in Shanghai outperform the 10% of the most privileged students in much of Europe or the United States. Very impressive outcomes, so very worth looking at. And that's what I want to do in the last part of my presentation, actually, highlight some of the policies that relate to quality and equity. I'm going to order them by their impact on outcomes as we measure it, but I also want to take into account the economic and political cost of educational reform. We all want to focus on the kind of things that are easy to do and very important. Nobody wants to talk about the things that are actually not so important, but actually very hard and very expensive to do. Unfortunately, in education, still a lot of things fall in that category. We want to move the frontier forward, doing the kind of things that are really hard to do, but very important. And then you can always pick up some low-hanging fruits, things that are maybe not so difficult to do, but also not so important. I want to sort of map some of the factors that we have observed into this diagram, and I'm going to lead you through them one by one. I want to start with something that, you know, sounds very easy, but it's actually very hard to do. That's why I put it very high, very important, but much to the left. And that's basically this commitment to universal performance that we see in the highest performing countries. Commitment to education. The belief that every student can succeed, that competencies can be learned. Those countries typically have universal educational standards. And at the very same time, they're very good in personalizing educational experiences, no? As opposed to countries that have a lot of stratification, tracking, streaming in their education systems. High-performing systems are also very good to articulate who is responsible for ensuring student success and whom. Let's have a look at a couple of data slides on this. This belief in, you know, universal success is actually mirrored in what students tell us. When we ask students, you know, what makes you really successful in mathematics, for example, many students in the Western world told us that has all to do with talent. If I'm not born as a genius in mathematics, I better study something else. Well, if you ask that question to a student in Shanghai or in Singapore, many of those students tell you, if I try really hard, I trust my teachers are going to help me. I'm going to be successful. And that perceived self-efficacy, the ownership of learning, actually is a very powerful determinant of success within countries, but even between countries, as you can see here in this chart. And it's also related to a dimension that I haven't talked so much about yet. You know, I talked a lot about socioeconomic disparities, but gender disparities in some countries are even larger. One of the things that we see is that boys tend to have greater beliefs in their mathematics abilities than girls. And now you tell me, well, that's all to do with their better performance in mathematics, but it's not, because in this chart I've already accounted for differences in math performance. The dot would be the gender gap that would be unadjusted for. So there seems something in our education systems that gives boys, irrespective of their math ability, a greater sense of ownership in their success in mathematics. And in fact, those things do matter. One of the things that we saw is, you know, this is the gender gap adjusted for differences in mathematics, self-efficacy. And what you can see actually in most countries, we wouldn't see any gender differences in the math performance if we actually ensured that boys and girls get an equally high sense of ownership for the learning in math. And this is the gender gap that we actually observe. So we could actually get rid of much of the disparities in the performance between boys and girls, achieve much more equitable results if we did a better job in basically giving students this universal strong belief that their investment in learning is going to make a difference for them. And you can see that actually even mirrored at the society level. In the East Asian countries, you know, you go to China, parents and grandparents are willing to invest the last resources in the education of their children. In Europe, we are starting to borrow money from our children to finance our consumption today. And those things are actually the mirror image in society of what you can see here in terms of self-efficacy. Those things actually do matter. On this chart, I show you the percentage of girls and boys who report feeling helpless when doing a math problem. That's the kind of counterpart to self-efficacy. And you can see actually this feeling of helplessness is actually much greater among girls than it's among boys. But in some countries, actually, it is very high in general. If you think about it, in France, you know, a very wealthy country, more than half of the girls tell you, I really feel helpless when I face mathematics. So students are confronted with high expectations, but very little in terms of individual student support. If you're in the Netherlands, both boys and girls actually report much less of these kinds of issues. So what have we learned from this? It's all about a continuum of support. It's about making learning central, encouraging engagement, responsibility, ownership for learning. It's being acutely sensitive to individual differences among students, understanding that students learn differently. It's about providing continual assessment with formative feedback, about being demanding for every student and ensuring that students feel valued and included, and that learning is collaborative. Let's get to the next issue, gateways and structural systems. I'm not going to talk about them that much because that is all quite well established. High-performing systems tend to have clear, ambitious goals. They are typically aligned with high-stakes gateways and structural systems. Every student, every teacher, every parent knows what counts in education, what is important to achieve, and so on. So systems also show a high level of metacognitive content. That is, students do not just learn something, but they understand that kind of meta level of education. Let's get to something that's very close to your agenda and very, very important, no? But also very hard to achieve. Capacity at the point of delivery. This is about, you know, attracting, developing, retaining the best teachers and school leaders and providing them with a work organization in which they can actually use their potential. It's about instructional leadership, about how do we develop, manage talent in schools? How do we keep teaching attractive? How do we build system-wide career development into those systems? put it to the left, really hard to achieve, but very, very important. Let's have a couple of data points on that. Now, how do teachers actually work with each other, learn from each other? This is data from our TALIS survey, and they show actually when it comes to informal exchange and coordination, actually, that happens generally in most countries quite frequently. But when it comes to the kind of deep professional collaboration that you really want to see, team teaching, collaborative professional development, joint activities, classroom observations, they're actually quite rare in most countries. There's some variability in this. Now, if you, for example, in Japan and Norway, in Italy, in the Czech Republic, team teaching actually is quite common. Collaborative professional development, again, you know, in the UAE, in Israel, in Singapore, in Australia, collaborative professional development, you know, is quite sort of the norm for many teachers. About half of them say they do that at least once per month. But if you are in France, in the Netherlands, in the Czech Republic, it's quite rare. And so on. There is variability in this. But overall, we must say professional collaboration, the figures are often still quite disappointingly low. Why do I say this is an issue? Because those things are a driver of job satisfaction. The more frequently teachers report that they participate in collaborative practices with their colleagues, the higher the level of self-efficacy, now their confidence in making a difference, and also in job satisfaction. Those aspects are really important. We asked teachers also to what extent they actually need professional development. And here's a list of the kind of things that teachers feel need to be better developed. Teaching students with special needs, now students with disadvantage, students with particular talents. Embracing diversity is the number one issue. ICT skills, very important. New technologies in the workplace, and so on. Knowledge of the curriculum didn't seem to be a big priority for most teachers. Now, these are average figures. Again, there's a lot of variability in this. If you're in Japan and Korea, those teachers particularly express a need to develop their skills to deal with student diversity. Hey, ask yourself, they do already really well. Now, those students in very large classes are actually, those teachers are very successful in embracing students with different learning needs. Now, remember, in Japan and Korea, social background makes very little of a difference in terms of learning. Still, the teachers feel they need a lot more of that. So maybe these numbers don't just give us an objective picture where more professional development is needed, but they also tell us something about how teachers set the bar. Pedagogical competences. If you are in Korea, 30% of the teachers say they need more development of their pedagogical competences. If you're in England, close to 0%. Teachers don't feel they need more pedagogy. Well, do they need more pedagogy or not? We don't really know. This is just a perceived perception. But what's important, it may tell us about the actual need, but it may also tell us something about how teachers, where teachers set the bar for where they want to be. Knowledge of the curriculum, same thing. You know, you have some countries where teachers say, well, I need to really know more content. If you are in Spain, very few teachers believe that they need better content knowledge. So, very important differences that we see across countries. Why is it important? Because it makes a difference. Regardless of the content, over 3/4 of teachers say that the professional development in which they have participated had a positive impact on their teaching. Last but not least, I mentioned already teacher satisfaction. These things relate to the way in which we organize the work of teachers. And we can actually see that the advantages of being a teacher clearly outweigh the disadvantages. That's what the large majority of teachers actually say. If you look to a country like Japan, it's a bit shorter. There's some variability across countries, but it's generally a very, very high level. What's interesting is that, you know, you ask yourself, what are the drivers of job satisfaction? And, you know, we can't really see much of an impact of classes. Basically, you can see whether the classes are small or large, job satisfaction tends to be consistently high or consistently sort of average. I show you here the average across countries and the figures for Japan, just to give you an idea of the range. Whereas you can see that behavioral differences really sort of impact a lot on job satisfaction. Now, where you have a lot of students with behavioral problems, job satisfaction is a lot lower. very important to keep that in mind. Incentives and accountability, that's a topic you're well familiar with. One of the things that we see is that high-performing systems do not put the primary emphasis of accountability on accountability for teachers or schools, but they do a lot to shape the ways in which incentive structures shape how gateways affect the strengths, direction, clarity, and nature of the incentives operating on students. Basically, getting students to take tough courses. They also sort of encourage teachers to make innovations in pedagogy and or the organization of their work to improve their own performance, but also that of their colleagues, and to pursue professional development that leads to stronger educational practice. The systems typically have a really interesting balance between vertical and lateral accountability. Both relate not just to the quality of education, but also to equity. We can also see that the way in which decisions are distributed varies across countries. Now, if you're on the right side of the chart, for example, in Japan, in the Netherlands, the UK, schools are the primary driver of curricula and also assessment policies. If you're on the left side of the chart, schools have relatively limited influence on those issues. And you can see actually across countries there is a mild relationship between, you know, having more discretion and doing better as a school. You can ask yourself, well, the UK leads in school autonomy, but still it doesn't lead in learning outcomes. So there are other factors relating to this as well. And I want to show you just a couple of them. On the horizontal axis, you see the degree of school autonomy. And on the axis behind, you see whether students have schools have a shared understanding of what good mathematics is. And on the vertical axis, you see the performance. If you are in an education system where there is no shared understanding of what good performance is, you can actually see that the more autonomous schools are doing worse than the less autonomous schools. But if you're in a school system where there is a strong sort of shared notion, strong notion of what good performance is, standardized policy for math, we call it, you can actually see how school autonomy works in your favor. Interestingly, there's another dimension to this. If you are in a school system where school autonomy means principals can decide on everything, but teachers are not really part of that equation, you can see that school autonomy works against you. The more autonomous schools actually do worse than the less autonomous schools. But if you're in a school system where we have an approach of distributed leadership, where teachers are part of the management of the school system, you can actually see that this interacts positively with school autonomy, and the more autonomous schools come out better. That's why it's so important to look at governance issues, not in isolation, but in combination. I want to come to an issue that quite strongly relates to equity-related outcomes. That's why I put it very high on the agenda, and one where actually evidence suggests teachers, school leaders, and countries could actually achieve a lot with limited investments. This is about aligning resources with the challenges, and it's about effective spending choices. Let's have a look at some of the data. First of all, you know, our data show that if you are in a wealthy country where a lot of money is being spent on students, or about $50,000 or more per year, you can actually see that, you know, spending per student no longer relates to learning outcomes. You saw that in the initial part of my presentation as well. But actually, if you are in a country where there is actually very little money available, you can see that money is very, very important, spending per student. So it's an important message. Up to a point, it is really important to make sure that all students have a reasonable investment. Whereas beyond the point, you have to start thinking about other things. What is more interesting and more relevant to the industrialized world, that equity in resource allocation matters as much as overall spending. On this chart, I show you on the vertical axis the performance, on the horizontal axis, not the amount of money that is being spent, but how well the resources are aligned with the challenges. This is about, you know, making sure that the students with the greatest need have access to the best resources. If you are beyond the zero line, actually we can say there is positive investment in the greater challenges. If you're to the left of the zero line, actually we are investing resources regressively. That is, you come from a privileged background, you're going to end up with the better teachers, the more resources, and so on. Unfortunately, in most of the countries, that's the case. But there are a couple from which we can learn that actually do invest their resources more equitably. And what's interesting, if you look at the overall pattern, it is that a more equitable spending of money doesn't only give you more equitable outcomes. You know, that's what you would expect. But it also gives you better outcomes. Those countries tend to be showing higher levels of performance, at least on average. And this suggests that more equitable investment also is more efficient investment. You can also sort of have a look at this in terms of how resources are invested. Now, educational resources in most countries, actually in almost all countries, are a lot more problematic in disadvantaged schools. Now, if you are in Peru and Costa Rica and Mexico and Brazil, that gap is very, very large. Disadvantage often implies also access to resources that are less quality. In other countries, you go to the right side of the chart, it looks a lot better, but still, the challenge prevails in most countries. Some people, you know, have attributed a lot of importance to whether schools are run by public authorities or private bodies. In fact, you know, we've looked at that closely, and in most countries, we don't see much of a difference once you control for the social background of schools. The white dot shows you what we observe. You can see that in most countries, private schools tend to show better performance than public schools. But once you actually take into account the context from which those students come in the schools, we don't see much of a performance difference. There's some interesting patterns where that is not true. You know, you look at Vietnam or look to Switzerland, you can actually see, even after accounting for students and shows the status, you can see that private schools actually have a big performance advantage. But in most countries, that's not so clear. A learning system. High-performing systems tend to continually looking outward to keep the system learning. And they have the eyes and ears that actually tell them where they can learn from other countries. They also recognize challenges and potential future threats to their current success. And last but not least, a lot has to do with coherence in the system. Aligning policies across all aspects of the system, making sure that they are sustained over time, that they are consistently implemented and with a high degree of fidelity in the classroom. This is what really, and I want to just sort of wrap this up. If you think about it, what it all means to move towards a high quality and equitable education system. Student inclusion. In the past, basically, some students succeeded. And that was enough because our economies were working well with a few students showing very high levels of performance. Today, we do need to ensure that all students learn at high levels because the price for inequalities has become unsustainably high. Curriculum and assessment. In the past, it was all about, you know, routine cognitive skills, not teaching students something and expecting them that that's going to be lasting for their lifetime. Today, in this uncertain, ambiguous world, it's all about learning to learn. It's about complex ways of thinking. It's about complex ways of working. That requires a very different approach to teaching. That requires the teachers actually work as high-level professional knowledge workers, not only with a lot of investment in their initial preparation, but with continued investment in their development day by day, year after year. The issue is that professional knowledge workers don't like to work in an industrial work organization that is hierarchical, tayloristically organized, with administrative accountability dominating. But they look to flat, collegial work organizations that mirror what we see in other professions. And that has implications on the approaches to accountability. In the past, accountability was primarily upwards in the system. Today, high-performing systems are looking primarily outwards. They're connecting the teacher to the teacher in the next classroom, connecting the school to the next school, and connecting education systems internationally. Whatever internationally comparative data have shown is that we can succeed to provide all students with adequate learning opportunities, with high quality learning opportunities, and with great success in learning outcomes. We've also seen that the socioeconomic background from which students come is a major challenge to education systems. But some education systems are much more successful than others in moderating that impact. And that tells us that we can see a lot of progress if we invest in the right policies and practices. Thank you very much.